Welcome to Palmer Museum's fundraiser called Untold Stories. This is our second installment. We're very excited to have such a full house. My name is Kai West, and they asked me to come MC, basically introduce these wonderful storytellers, and I get to hear the stories all over again because I got to hear them once before, and it was quite a treat. So once again, thank you for supporting Palmer's museum. Let me tell you a story about something that happened to me. When I say this to my classroom full of fidgeting students, all eyes lock right on me. Instantly, the kids sit down, get comfortable, without even being directed. Anticipating what? Entertainment? No, it's more than that. Making personal connections, whatever it is, it commands their full attention, and it's a beautiful thing. Everyone has a story to tell. Tonight we will hear 7 stories about preparing for winter, something we all do here in Alaska, and we're doing right now. We invite you to sit back and get comfortable and enjoy these untold stories from people in your community. Bill Schmidtkins hails from Sutton, Alaska, his home. His stories are told in verse. Bill shares his experiences of winter during different stages of a journey in poems of home. Let's give him a round of applause.
Preparing for winter. There's a lot of ways we prepare for winter. Sometimes it's putting up our wood or harvesting our garden, things like that. Did you get your moose? And there's other ways of preparing for winter as well. And sometimes it's the winter of your life and you're, you know, wondering how you're going to get through that. Is there a spring at the end of it? I have some poems I'd like to read to you tonight about preparing for winter. Bill and Katie Long, my in-laws, used to live for years at Moose Creek Ranch. They were the premier horse instructors in the state of Alaska. And getting a little closer here, okay. And preparing for winter at that ranch was a big deal. In 2007, they had to move on from aging issues and other things. And I had to go down there and repair a lot of the things that needed to be done so the house could be sold. The day I finished a massive deck on their house, the next day we had like 6 inches of snow. It was absolutely beautiful. I went down there and sat on their deck and thought about them and their journey. This is called October. Our last days on the farm porch, lives more bark than leaves. We listen in silence to Moose Creek swimming through the roots of cottonwoods and the lumbered tailings of the railroad coal bridge. Swallow nests in the barn are empty, and the unfinished chores rust with the tools. The moods of the coming seasons will now write their own words in the patterns of the paths that crossed our fields, in the patterns that webbed a life. Other patient rhythms must take us through the difficult work to where again we feel light and alive. Doors are open, windows filled with light. We will feel welcome there, warmed by other fires that will hold us through these new, cooler winds. Of course, my wife, growing up in a family with horses, we had horses and ponies and a bunch of other animals too over the years. And preparing for winter is preparing for a very large animal. There's hay that has to get in, and is the hay going to be good? Is it sour? Do you have the pellets? Do you have to call a farrier? Do you need a vet? All these things you have to go through. And at the end of one of those long days, you're exhausted. And I wrote this. It's called Beautiful House. We are sitting happy. Pick up load of hay, enough for wintered horses now semi-drunk by wood stove trying to feed the soul. Dreams in the flames are as stones brought down from mountains by glaciers. And if I took the time to carry them all back, it will be a different mountain. And if I could gather up the flames, they will not make another tree. Then it would not matter what I name myself or where I make my home. The work will unfold to where I worry less and find some understanding in this journey. The way of living, the way of being, and the way home. I don't really know where poetry comes from. I tend to write in the evening when I'm tired and my mind doesn't get in the way of what I'm trying to say. I was looking through a used book and this little card fell. It was a child's playing card, Animal Rummy. It was very small for tiny hands. And I imagined the children playing that game and what their house was like and how the people there thought about their lives and how it was going. And I wrote this. It's called Card Players. Wind drives a gull cry past single-pane windows. Claire plays Animal Rummy, a flush of pheasants in her hand. Tom lays down three dolphins. Apples and currants, the last of the cinnamon, and a cobbler goes into the wood stove. In the end, all this living may prove out we were wrong all along, but there were few options in front of us after we weighed out the risks. Is this the beginning, or are we further along? Claire draws a unicorn. I really like, one of my favorite poems that I wrote. I like in the end where Claire draws a unicorn. It's like a magic talisman that she's going to be okay, you know. She's going to work it out. I have two brothers. My oldest brother is Jim, and then I have Tom. Growing up, I did a lot of things with my brother Tom. And then in the 60s, he sort of got involved in other things, and then my older brother sort of stepped in and did a lot of things with me, which was real nice as a protector and whatnot. We're both about, I'm in my late teens, this poem is, I'm in my late teens, leaving high school, ready to move into college, and he's leaving college and about ready to go to Vietnam. So we're just driving around Wisconsin, which is where I grew up. Brother on the shotgun side. Radio preacher reminding us, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. We pass back and forth the 40, was colder at first swallow from the quick stop. Now I'm wondering, he's had it a bit longer than me. But that's like him, long with his stories and that endless pursuit of happiness. The wheel feels good on the road, worn asphalt but smooth. Passing farm vehicles heavy with hay, red-winged blackbirds on marsh cattails. Basho's frog in there flopping about, hoping someone gains enlightenment, but it won't be us. We're just moving too fast for frogs, too fast for Basho, not to mention enlightenment. The roadside waitress takes all our spare change, scrounged from blue jean pockets every last dime, and piled beside our plates like her beehive hairdo we thought so. We're loud for a while after we leave, then quiet. Now it's just the headlights into the darkness, then more cars merging into our lane, and suddenly realize we're going home. I tried college for a while. It didn't work out very well for me. But the best thing about it was my creative writing teacher who was a big fan of Walt Whitman, and we were reading Song of the Open Road, and then he just casually mentioned this other book about this guy that wrote On the Road. You know, that story. We've all been through that. So after class, I went down to the bookstore, and there it was, and I opened it up, and how literature can change and save your life is just incredible. I read that book, and I knew exactly what I had to do. And so I got a backpack, and I hit the road for about 5 years. And I rode Greyhound buses, and I walked, and did a lot of walking, a lot of hitchhiking. My favorite was riding on boxcars and trains. There's a real nice ride from Whitefish, Montana, you take at night, and it'll bring you into Spokane, Washington in the morning. It's just an incredible journey. It took me a few days across Nebraska in a boxcar to learn the entrance act from Carmen on my harmonica. Cold I was that night. Could not tell the frozen constellations from farm lights. Did the dipper crash into the wheat fields? No sleeping bag. And every morning, that blessed dawn of light, a starting point. Simple man on the road, nearly home, perhaps. But still those what-ifs so ridiculously in front of me, what I could not see. Trying to feel it. Thumb out to the wind. One ride at a time. In Milwaukee, I worked for about at least 4 years as a paperboy, delivering the Milwaukee Journal in the evening. And every house is a different reality. And if I knew how to write then, I probably could have written like a Winesburg, Ohio of every house and all the different characters that are in it. This particular woman I think of a lot, and it took me a long time to write something about her, but I finally did. This is called Paperboy. South Side, Lower Flat. A bar down National Avenue she once danced in, closed for repairs. Snow and window panes, Christmas lights. She snores through the coming of the Magi. Delivered the papers, never tipped. Made me dump her garbage. 15. Didn't have the words then to explain anything. Just walked up the steps to the next apartment. I have a very spirited daughter. Her new habit is climbing to the tops of mountains and then taking a wing out of her backpack and jumping. And the first couple of times you see that, all I can think was, man, I just spent $8,000 straightening out her teeth, you know. And she'll say, don't worry, Dad, I'm wearing a helmet, you know. But of course, it doesn't cover the teeth, you know. So, we've spent a lot of time together this summer, unexpectedly, and we'd go to Hatcher Pass every time she would swing by and do this. You know, she would jump and then I'd walk back down and she'd meet me in the parking lot. They call themselves pilots. And this poem is called Pilot, and this is for Hattie. From an asphalt parking lot to a rock-shattered weather station at the peak, 3,000 feet through tundra plants, no taller than our boots. Ground squirrel chirps and rock pika whistles, marking the trail. Dad following daughter. Oranges at the peak. Take a few pictures. Camera leveled on rocks, and even though we are on firm ground, we're always laughing crooked in the frame. And then her pack opening like a cocoon, an unfolding wing, butterfly blue. Thin as air, waiting on lichen ledge. Her wing fills with blue sky. To be able to judge it, that leap, not always easy. To trust the accuracy of her judgment, the disciplined method within her independent nature, knowing when to relax. I gather up the orange peels into the pack and slowly make my way back down the mountain, leaving it up to her to find those soft landings and willing to accept whatever the earth yields. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Wonderful poems. In 1940, things brought into Alaska all arrived by steamship. This included a one-year-old boy by the name of Dan Renshaw. Dan's father met his family at the dock in Seward. Thence, the continuing trip by railroad and car took them home to the Gold Cord Mine in the Willow Creek Mining District, what we now know as Independence Mine in Hatcher Pass. There, Dan began the growing up process, younger years absorbing the detail behind the times and seasons, those many details that create the untold story of hidden purpose and reason. Tonight, he will ask of you, are you ready for winter? That is, the winter of 1940. Dan Renshaw.
Thank you, Kai. The winter of 1940, my, what did it have to do with the winter that we're faced with? You never know. The whole essence of the winter of 1940 were the people getting ready for the road closure in the Willow Creek Mining District. Perhaps you know that better today as the Hatcher Pass area. But in 1940, it was a very busy area having to do with gold mining primarily. There was a number of things that had to be done because of road closure on October 10th. Vary a day or two either side, but you could almost always depend on being snowed in by the 10th of October. My, how things have changed. In 1935, you're all well familiar with the colony that was established here in Palmer area in Matanuska Valley. The farmers that were establishing themselves needed more than anything a market for their product, and it was readily available in the form of the mines in the Willow Creek District. They were hungry for the produce. And it worked out very well because by 1940 there was an established trade where an awful lot of the produce, especially the fall harvest, went directly to the mines where they would store it. And, again, it was necessitated by road closure that they would store this produce for the winter. This allowed the farmers to not have to store it in root cellars with all of the labor required to keep their crops from freezing. So it was a big benefit for this trade to be going on. The various mines in the Willow Creek District handled their problem on road closure differently. For example, at the Gold Cord Mine, the mine portal is right in camp. The tunnel level for the 200 level of the mine is right there. Underground then, in a special little side drift, was the refrigerator. Constant temperature underground, 38 degrees. Well, this was perfect for the storing of potatoes, cabbages, and carrots. A long bench was created in this drift, and by the time the 1st of October came, crates were to the ceiling level. There was a lot of produce stored, ready for the winter. This would take a lot of maintenance because in order to keep this produce from deteriorating, The bull cook, who visited daily to get his basket full for the day's requirements for the cookhouse, would have to keep check of how things are doing, check crates to make sure, for example, that the cabbage was getting soft, you had to exfoliate a leaf or two. The carrots oftentimes had to be topped at critical times to keep them. They seemed to be preserved best if stored vertically. A lot of little oddities. The potatoes, here they are stored throughout the winter in this cold, dank, dark hole in the ground. Come spring, early spring, they would have no communication with the surface, but they knew there was sun had returned. So every potato had to be cleaned of its sproutings. And a lot of work went into maintaining this. The preparation for winter was, we take for granted today our state of Alaska DOT. We really do. You may have individual gripes and complaints with them on your driveway, perhaps. But consider in 1940, the territory of Alaska was a poor stepchild of a federal father that was located thousands of miles away in Washington, D.C. Funding for the Alaska Road Commission was kind of an afterthought. It was never enough to do what was really required. The equipment that we have today, my, it's marvelous, does a great job, and I'm in awe of how well they maintain things. Back in 1940, there was no way to maintain the road when winter came. It was an extraordinary effort. The equipment was not adequate. There was nothing could be done. The roads were closed and would be closed then until probably early May, sometime in May, and then they would make an effort to reopen the road. So there was this requirement of 7 months that you better be ready for winter. There was, at the gold cord mine, there was a dedicated meat room that was full of sides of beef and pork, and along one side there was big stacks of bacon, and this was sides of bacon now that are in a waxed outside paper, inside in a coat of burlap, and they would survive and remain, you know, with quotations around the word edible. We really need to define that one. It's interesting talking to primarily the cooks would talk about it, that as winter progressed, the various things that were fed to the crew, they would ask, is this all right? And, oh yeah, it's great. Of course, they're getting used to this change. One of the items that was most noted for testing the waters on the change were boat eggs. Now, a lot has been written about boat eggs over the years, especially by people who lived in Anchorage, for example. They got so used to the eggs being older that in latter years, when eggs became available through local farms and air freighted in, they couldn't stand them. They were tasteless. But there's occurrences told about at the various mines where along about spring, the cook would keep talking to the crew. Now, are the eggs okay? Oh, yeah, they're fine. But what he really wanted to hear was, no, we can't stand them anymore, because he wanted to throw them out. He couldn't stand cooking them. But everybody got used to these gradual changes. There was, at other mines throughout the mining district that didn't have a portal close to the camp, they would have to create a pantry for the maintenance of all of these perishable items and carefully monitor the temperature of it, not freezing, but essentially a walk-in refrigerator. All of the produce, all of the meat, all of the eggs, all of these perishable items. A big pile in the fall and dwindling through the winter. Occasionally, like at the Lucky Shot mine, they would, when conditions allowed, they had a tractor, and they could make a trip down to Willow and get some fresh provisions come spring. The Independence mine also did some freighting that way. In the early days, there was a very interesting gentleman that lived down at the community of Fishhook. It's not there anymore. Where the Fishhook Creek now crosses the road to Hatcher's Pass and enters the little Susitna River, right there, there was a community called Fishhook. One of the gentlemen that lived there was a gentleman named Landers, last name Landers, and he was very good at teaching his horses to walk on snowshoes. And in the early years, in the 30s, he could deliver produce and other things to the mines in the wintertime when nobody else could. But 1940, I use that particular date because that was the last, you know, quote-unquote, last good winter. When 41 came, you're all familiar with the date December 7th, everything changed. And that change is with us yet and continuing to change. It's dramatic when you think about all the things that can be focused back to that single date. I remember, now in 1940, I'm too young to have a remembrance of that particular winter, but the winters that followed, the preparation for it, being a little boy standing in a corner in the cookhouse was fascinating to me, watching all of the activity. One of the things that was paramount in everybody's list of hierarchy of what a cookhouse had to produce was the quality of the coffee. And coffee was very interesting to a little boy watching. The pot was huge. I mean, it was very tall, very heavy. To pour a cup of coffee took two hands. The coffee that was stored for the winter was fresh out of Seattle. Hills Brothers at the time was the premium brand. And these were in large tins with a kind of a porthole-sized lid on top, metal cans, very well sealed. The coffee was very coarse ground. In fact, I have to believe it was also screened because there were no fines in it. It was very coarse coffee. And this would go into the pot in the morning and create a continuous stream of coffee. And watching the cooks, what else they threw in the coffee pot, especially eggshells went into the coffee pot. But through the day, the coffee pot would be reinvigorated and boiled some more water. By the time evening came, it was more grounds than water. And it was up to the bull cook then to, in the middle of the night, before the morning came, he had to dump the coffee pot, clean it up, and start over again. The grounds were so dry, so pure, that he would dry them then for a floor sweeping compound. Can you imagine doing that with your coffee grounds? It wouldn't work. But the effort that went into collecting all of the pantry goods, the canned goods that would be needed. And then you think about all of the little items that would make a difference in a little bit of variety for a crew that was working through the winter in an underground mine. It all added up to a large number of items. And today, I think we've got it pretty soft when we don't have to worry about when the next trip to the store is going to take place. So, are you truly ready for winter?
Thank you.
Just makes you want to hear more and more, doesn't it? Winter in Alaska versus winter in, say, another country. Is it so different? Maybe not. Let's listen to Sarah Rowley, a fellow Alaskan, share an experience in a foreign land some of you might find very close to home in her story, Grandma in the Banya.
After living in Russia for 9 years, you gather a lot of really good stories. But my best stories come from when I was a foreign exchange student, because nothing can compare to living with a family. I had been living with my Russian family for about a month, and my language was not improving at all. And my Russian grandma didn't speak any English, but we were managing to communicate. There's always gestures and the odd game of charades. And then there's her favorite method, which was ragdoll. She would just grab me and make me do what she wanted and what she thought needed to be done. That was just how we communicated. And she had a very strong will, and so that meant succumbing to her quite often. It meant eating buckwheat every morning, which I abhorred. And it meant standing for inspection every day before I could leave the house so she could make sure I was dressed warmly enough. Which, of course, I was never dressed warmly enough. But there was one thing that I would not back down on. Every day she would ask me to go to the banya with her. All I knew about the banya was that it was hot, and there were a bunch of naked people sitting around beating each other with branches. It did not sound like my ideal Friday night. So I would change the subject every time. But then the wind started coming in, and the snow started to fall, and it was really cold. Not even Grandma could dress me warmly enough for that cold. And so one day, reluctantly, when she asked me, I said, well, can I bring a friend? Oh, absolutely. And like that, my Friday night was set. And so Friday came, and I met my friend Kim down at the tram stop. We walked back to my apartment up the four flights of stairs and met Grandma, who was excitedly waiting for us at the door. She sat there with her list of questions. Do you have a towel? Yes, packed a towel. Do you have your shower shoes? Yep, packed my shower shoes. Do you have your beanie? I looked at Kim. What, you know, my Russian wasn't, what did she just say? You know, do you have your stocking cap? What are you going to wear on your head? I thought, no, I must not be translating this right. So she went over to the wardrobe, grabbed out two winter hats, and gave them to us to pack in our bags. So I packed it, not knowing what it was for. And she then gave us each a piece of chocolate cake and tea in a jar, and out the door we headed. We went down the stairs, out the front door, and we met another Russian grandma. Evidently, if I could invite a friend, she could invite one too. And so there we went, two Russian grandmas and two American girls carrying our birch branches through the streets of Russia, as if to proclaim to the whole world exactly where we were going. And so we walked about 2-3 blocks, and we get to this old, dilapidated, three-story brick building, and I walk past it, and my grandma stops me, no, grabs me like her rag doll and turns me to go inside. So this is the infamous banya. I'm starting to get a little more nervous than I already was. We walk in the front door, and I see two old cashiers, you know, behind the window working, and grandma goes and talks to them, and then we walk up a flight of stairs and down a long corridor to what turns out to be the woman's ward of this banya. We walk to the very end of this dimly lit corridor, and I sit down on a bench and wait, and I'm just watching all these people, having no clue what's in store for me next. As Grandma goes in and gets us all checked in, she then calls me forward and grabs me like her rag doll and shoves me in the dressing room, which, let's be honest, is an undressing room. And before I put my bag down to settle in, I turn around to face my chubby old grandma, and find her totally in the buff. And the damage was done for this young girl. That image is just ingrained. But of course, she wasn't completely in the buff. She had her shower shoes and her stocking cap on her head. So she grabbed her birch branches and headed off into the abyss. Kim and I looked at each other and started slowly undressing, you know, and you're trying to cover yourself as best you can when there's really no way you can. When I get all the way down to my shower shoes, I realize I don't have a rubber band, and my hair's all the way down to my waist, and it's pretty thick. How am I supposed to get it up into this stocking cap? So I'm trying very unsuccessfully, and eventually I just have to bend over and let Kim, my friend, shove it up as best she can. When we're finally situated, I head back into the abyss to find my grandma and her friend, and we find them soaking the birch branches in the back room. The back room was just all cement with different water faucets and buckets, and some of the cement is in bench form, and it's just a room like I had never seen. And so the grandmas are soaking the branches to get them to the proper pliability, and they're pouring water on themselves in preparation. So I fill up a bucket and dump it over my head and get ready to head back into the Vanya. When the branches are finally soft enough to beat each other with, into hell we enter. There's a giant black metal door, two stories tall. And of course, we open it and run in as fast as we can to shut the door because God forbid any cold air enter this room. And you can't really see anything. The fire is contained, but it is hot. I thought I was going to pass out as soon as we entered. But of course, we didn't just enter, we went up. Up one flight of stairs, down to the very back, right next to the fire, when I thought it couldn't get any hotter. And I wedged myself in between some random grandma and my friend Kim, and I just put my head down, praying, God, please let me survive this. And before I know it, evidently my grandma is not the only one who likes the ragdoll method, because another grandma grabs me by the arm and pulls me into the middle of the room, pushes my head down, and my rear is hanging out for everybody to see, and she starts beating me on the back. Because while I was there praying that I would survive this, everybody else was beating themselves, and I wasn't, and they saw a way to remedy that. So from my head all the way down to my calves and back up, the grandmas took turns beating me. When I was sufficiently red all over, they handed me the branches and showed me how to beat my front. And then they grabbed my friend Kim and put her in the middle and faced her butt towards me and started beating her. After I don't know how long we were in this banya, maybe 10, 15 minutes, I really did think I was going to pass out. And so our little gang made it down the stairs, out that big, scary black door, back into the big cement water room. And the two grandmas grabbed ice-cold buckets of water and threw them at each other. I'm covered in leaves and red welts, and I feel crap. And I think, that looks awesome. And so I grab a bucket and I chuck it at my friend Kim, and she throws one in my face, and it was the best water fight ever. And by now, all inhibitions are gone, and so we're scrubbing each other's backs and giving each other the real Russian banya bath experience. When we're all clean, the grandmas go in for round two. Kim and I, being a little bit wiser, decide it's time to head to the dressing room and eat our chocolate cake. And so, wrapped in a towel, eating chocolate cake and drinking tea from a jar, I realize it's the most relaxed I have ever been in that country. And so when the grandmas are finished and it's time to head home, my grandma didn't yell at me that I didn't put a hat on or tie my scarf or zip up my coat. She was so happy that I had warmed myself from the inside out. So we walked home that night, hand in hand, loving each other and ready for Russia's winter.
That sounds like so much fun. Thank you for that story. Well, some might say, back to the basics. Others might say, living out in the bush. Alice Culhane has learned the hard way how to live with livestock in her story called Off the Griddle. Alice.
You've all heard of, maybe haven't all heard of the sitcom Green Acres. Remember Lisa and Oliver, and they lived in Hooterville after they moved there from New York City, and they did some strange things, like Oliver took Lisa's flapjacks, which were solid, and he nailed them up on the roof. And my friend Christopher Benson said that our place was a lot like their place, and I said to him, yeah, right, they're off the griddle and we're off the grid, right? Well, that gave me many times reason to pause, and I thought, well, really not like Green Acres, because they were at Universal Studios where the sun shone all winter long, and they also didn't have horses to deal with, and that has become kind of the center of my life. And also, I think often when people talk about preparing for winter, what I learned about being resourceful in that particular context. The first winter that we had horses, I was not prepared at all. I thought that I was. I was dressed like this, right? Had a rainstorm, had snow on top of it, had to go out 11 o'clock at night and take care of, right then, three horses. Okay, so. I don't have 5-gallon buckets here, but I had two open 5-gallon buckets. I didn't have these. I'm gonna use these in a minute. And I filled them with water in the bathtub, and then I proceeded to head down, we have a little slope, towards the barn. Okay, yes. And there is ice underneath the snow, right? And I got these slippery things on, and I'm kind of like creeping along, and all of a sudden, boom, I am on the ground, right? And I'm thinking, oh, and okay. The horses think that it's rightfully so. It's time for their nightcap. They got dinner at 6. They get a nightcap at 11 o'clock. So Rowdy, who's the matriarch of the thing, goes, and Siggy, her sibling, who does what she did, would start to go. So there's two of them making all this noise. Remember, I'm still on the ground. The water's starting to seep into my cotton jeans, right? And then there's the third horse, Tinny. He's the old guy, and he is from Iceland, and he's kind of reserved, and he decides to try it out. So there I am on the ground. I'm cold. I can hear these horses. I got to get them water. And I say, okay, so I get up to go back up the hill. I fall back down. It happened a couple times. I'm not able to get up this hill, and I'm getting livid, right? So what I do is I go down the hill, kind of up around. I creep up the driveway, back into the house. And Pete's there, and it's nice and warm, and a stove, and he goes, well, is everything okay? And I said, no, I can't stand this. I got to get rid of these horses. And he says, don't worry, we'll take care of it. It's okay. All righty. So I said, horses, you know, that's what they call heroin. You know, and trying to deal with this particular addiction. So Pete was actually true to his word, and over time we did get things straightened out so that things are somewhat manageable now with the horses, as I will kind of show you. I am semi-prepared for winter.
underwear, got wool socks, got lots of headlights. None of them work. Got gloves.
Notice, these are gloves are kind of tough because you don't want to get them wet, and they do get wet, and I haven't found the perfect gloves. But notice they don't match. I pulled them out of the drawer this morning, so we're not ready for winter.
And I got
cleats. Well, actually, there are two left cleats here.
No, the two right-handed gloves. Okay, I'm not done yet.
Yeah, this is a refrigerator suit. Yes, it's kind of battered and old now, but you put this on in October, you take it off in May. For actual watering now, I don't use the 5-gallon buckets, I use these 4-gallon horse supplement containers. Millennium Gold, and you notice that the handles have broken a few times, and Pete has taped them up, right? Okay, so we go down, before we get on the bar, we fill these up in the kitchen edition, then we pour the water into enamel bins on the wood stove, and the water heats up, then you pour the water back in there, and then... And this is my sled. My friend Vicky made it. I think if I'm careful, I get 2 or 3 more winters out of it. See, it's got these holes in it. So, what you do, put this here, and you put this one in the bag. You put that in the bag. Then it goes cattywampus and you're pulling it down the hill. And you kind of run with it. And sometimes it just slides where you want it to go and sometimes it doesn't. We're straight. Then you get down to where the horses are all going. Bang. And now there are 4 of them and they make quite the racket. So, you got your insulated bucket hanging on the wall. Pete did this insulation. So we don't have a water heater or the big trough. We just have 3 or 4 of these, and they're nicely insulated. They're hanging on the walls. You fill the water in them, and you only have them 3/4 of the way through so you can get most of the ice out of there. If you got ice, then you take your deep fat fryer thing from Bishop's Attic. You scoop the ice out and you toss it over the fence. Okay? So that's pretty much how you do it. And we have a system, or street, and you take care of it. Now, today, Pete was using this stick with one of those buckets and he was making the sauerkraut from the cabbages we grew. And I realized then why we do this and why we all do this here in Alaska is because there's great joy in being resourceful. You know, when you can figure something out with what you have, then you just realize that you have beaten hardship and that spring is on the way. Thank you.
Those are some special horses, Alice. Wow. One more round of applause. Okay, speaking of Betty Pierce, born and raised in Palmer, Alaska, Betty Pierce is one tough woman. Tonight, she shares just how brave one needs to be when facing the challenges of winter in Alaska in her tales from the trap line. Betty.
Here, can you guys hear me okay? Okay. Well, you know, I always got the inside. I was born and raised in Palmer up on Lazy Mountain, and my sister and I shared a bunk bed in a big bunk bed my dad built for four kids, a double size. So my sister and I were in the bottom bunk, and I got the inside by the wall. She got the outside, so she could get in and out anytime she wanted. We heated by wood, and it was very cool at night, and so the floors were cold, and so we would snuggle down our little blankets. And my sister, 4 years older than I was, loved to tease me, and she'd say, "I think there might be a shrew on your side of the bed." And I would scream and try to get out, and she'd hold me back. And I would be like, "Eva," and she'd be like, "Oh, I think I see it down there." Well, this is the start of my fear of shrews. My mother had a cat named Sandra Alice. She was a black cat, and she did kill shrews. She did a great job, but she didn't get all of the shrews. My mother, she would say, at night, she said, "I leave the cupboard doors open because I know those little shrews are in there and they need to get out so Sandra Alice can kill them." Well, as a child, I thought, I'm a little afraid of those little shrews coming out so Sandra Alice can kill them. Webster's dictionary defines a shrew as a chiefly nocturnal mammal. It's related to a vole, characterized by a long, pointy snout and tiny little eyes and velvety fur. Yeah, I've been afraid of shrews most of my life, for sure. When I got divorced, my parents gave me some land up on Lazy Mountain, a little land to build a cabin and to live in with my son, who was 15. And our first winter there, well, you know, shrews. And we had a little cabin, 16 by 24. I had a cat named Elvis. She was a very good hunter. I was, you know, kind of helped me. I'd see dead carcasses here and there and toss them out. I was grateful. In that fall, one evening, I went to bed like normal. I had to go to work the next day. And I woke up in the night. Elvis was particularly active in the bed, jumping around, jumping. And I was tired, and I thought, "Oh, stop it. Go lay down." So I rolled back over, and I went to sleep. In the morning, I got up, I flung the covers back, and I went downstairs, down my loft stairs, into the shower, ready for work, came upstairs, looking to get dressed, looked over on my bed in the imprint of my body, and yes, there was a dead shrew. I felt a silent scream come up inside of me. I felt dirty, too. I thought, golly. And then I thought, who's going to get this shrew out of my bed? There's just me. I live by myself. Well, my son, he wouldn't do it. So I thought, okay, I looked around my bedroom and I saw a box of sanitary napkins in the corner and I thought, aha. So I opened one up and I ripped that adhesive off and I held it like this and I slid over. I didn't want to look at that little vermin in my bed, but I figured that adhesive would stick to that velvety fur. So I did this, like this, and I got way down, and sure enough, stuck to that adhesive strip, wrapped it around like this. I had a good inch of cushioning between me and that little vermin, and I walked down the stairs screaming all the way, threw it out of the cabin. Oh my gosh. My son had to clear my bedroom for 2 weeks. Every night before I went to bed, he had to scan for shrews. And I slept with my light on for quite a bit longer than that. Well, you know, I had Elvis passed away, and I got another cat named Hunter. I really wanted Hunter, it's a Siamese, to kill. I mean, you know, Hunter, come on. But he wasn't a very good mouser, so I tried a snap trap. Well, those little shrews, they just lick off that stuff, or they'd steal the cheese, and I wasn't very good, and it wasn't working. And then I tried that bucket where you have the thing, the little where they go to the end, and then they fall in and they drown. That didn't work either. So the best thing that I found was the glue sticky traps. Yes, I'm one of those. I got a glue sticky trap, and I feel terribly guilty about it, actually. So I was talking to a friend, and I said, "You know, I'm a shrew killer." She said, "I'm a shrew hunter." I said, "I use glue sticky traps." She said, "I do too." I said, well, how do you deal with that? And she said, well, I just tell the universe, okay, little shrews, I don't want you in my space. This is my space, and I'm laying them out, and you all know that they're here. So if you come in my space, you're warned. There are sticky traps here. I thought, okay, that's a good one. Good. So I have sticky traps, right? So in January of this last year, actually, I need my stool for a minute. Sound effects, you know. In January of this last year, I woke up in the night, I heard, and I thought, crap, I live alone. I'm in the middle of the woods. I'm by myself. Someone's at my door. I'm like, crap, okay. All right, Betty, don't turn the light on because you don't want anybody to know that they're knocking on your door. So I get out of my bed carefully. I grab my shotgun, which is right by my bed because it's a 16 by 24 cabin. What could I miss with a shotgun in that, right? If I had to. So I got my shotgun. It's dark. Keep hearing that. I come down the stairs and I peer around the corner. I'm trying to see who's, because my cabin's so small, I know I can see. And there's nothing there. And then I realize it's coming from the bathroom where the glue sticky traps are. And then I think, okay, there's nobody here. You have to deal with this. I go down the stairs, I put my shotgun down. Think, okay, go in the bathroom. You just got to look and see what it is. How big could it be? I'm like, it could be pretty big. It's loud. So I said, okay, put your big girl pants on. So I go and I lean, and I have a tiny little bathroom, of course, because it's a tiny little cabin. And the glue sticky traps are in the toilets here, showers here, the sticky traps are right there. So I'm peering around trying to see what it's, and it's still. And I see the biggest rat bastard shrew jumping up and down, trying to get off the glue sticky traps that I've ever seen. And I scream and I run back out. And by this time, my dog Patton is like, oh my gosh, she wanted out of the cabin too. So I let her out. And then I thought, okay, Betty, okay, you're the only one here. You have to do this. How are you going to do it? You don't want to look it in the eyes. Oh my gosh, because it's jumping up and down and it's still doing this. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I got a dustpan. And I got a garbage bag and some gloves. And I thought, okay, go in there and just get that dustpan underneath that thing that's jumping up and down. Hold your bag here, throw it in there, and then throw it out of the cabin. So, yeah, great, okay, right? So I did it. I went in there, but I didn't want to look him in the eyes. I just was trying to, like, slide it under there, get it around, throw it in the bag. And then, so I was successful, and I threw it out of the house. And it's January. Okay, enough said, all right? I got the shrew out of the house. And I let Patton back in, and we calmed down. Well, you know, you guys, for many months since January, I have not had shrews. That hasn't been a problem. I actually found a little area where I thought they were coming in and out by the shower, and I put some caulking on there and threw a little bit of cardboard on there. And, I mean, I don't have a guy around, and I'm not a guy, and I just do all that and just hope that. I don't want to look. I just wanted to, like, stop it up so it doesn't just go away. So, okay, yesterday I had a long day at work. I was preparing for this story. I'm so excited about all our stories. I went over to my best friend's house, and they fed me dinner, bless their hearts, and I got to practice my story. So I practiced my shrew story, and I had an ending that was okay. And they, you know, were very wonderful. And I went home. I went back home, and I got to the cabin. It was 10:30 at night. I go to my little computer chair, which is right next to the bathroom, and I sit down, and I hear this, yin, 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 yin. I went, no. I haven't had a shrew for months. Yin, 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 yin. I'm like, no, it can't be a shrew. So I text my best friend and I say, I think there's a shrew in the bathroom. And she says, paybacks are a bitch, Betty. And so I'm like, yin, 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 yin. I'm thinking, oh, you got to do it. You got to put your bigger pants on again. I thought I solved this, right? And it's like, is it hopping on the sticky trap? What is it doing? I couldn't figure it out. So I thought, okay. And I went in the bathroom. And of course, here's the toilet. And I know the sticky trap's back here where the shower's there. And I think, okay, I'm going to look under the toilet and see if the sticky trap, if there's anything on there. So I lean way down. And there's nothing on the sticky trap. And I'm still hearing this little nyan, 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 nyan. I'm thinking, what is it? And I think, it must be big. It must have, like, tripped on the sticky trap, and it's laying over here. And I was just freaking out. So I thought, okay. text my friend, Anita, I can't do this. She says, put your big girl pants on, get in there. So I go in there and I look over and I don't see anything. And then I realize, it's coming from where I did that caulking with the cardboard. It's trying to come out. So I go back into the living room and think, okay, what are you gonna do? So I went back to assess the situation again, and that little rat bastard came out of the thing and ran. He skipped the glue trap. He ran for like, and I thought, okay, the battle is on. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Toughest woman in Alaska. That's awesome. Thank you, Betty. Bill Tull has many stories, so I'm told, and he loves to tell them. Tonight, he will tell us a story about a basic need when getting ready for winter, shelter, called Whoops, Bill Tull.
Okay. I was almost late. I came out of the house and I smelled that great smell, the perfume of autumn, high bush cranberries. I spent a few minutes picking them, and then I thought, well, you know, that was September, and it was September when my story starts. This was September in 59. I had filed on my homestead a year or two earlier, and in 58, I had Wild Bill Nelson. Does anybody know Wild Bill? Oh, my goodness. You don't forget him if you know him. Well, Wild Bill went out to my homestead site, cleared off a pad for me, and dug in a road for me, and that was about a mile. And that was a mile from the 2 mile road, which connected to the old Glen Highway, which you now call, what is they call the new name for the highway? Not the Glen, it was the old Glen, it's now the Parks, yeah. I still think of it as the Glen, but the Parks, and this was up in Meadow Lakes. Well, you know, I had to get ready for winter. I had filed on it the year before and hadn't done anything but had the pad cleared. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to start building and get serious now. And I was new up here. I was working at that time in the Matanuska Valley Bank. Do you remember that? It's not here anymore. I think we lost it in about 80. But anyhow, so I could just work weekends. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to get something going fast. And then I saw in the paper that the Alaska Railroad was having an auction of buildings and equipment. Well, you know, in 58, they stopped using coal. They stopped the steam engines, and they got on to diesel and whatever else would burn. And so they had this property to sell. Well, I thought, gee whiz, there's a chance maybe I can. And yes, there was. In the list of items to be auctioned off was a cabin. Well, it was a cabin to me. It was a coal shed. And it was 10 by 14. And it was at the old Pittman Station. Do you folks remember that? 7 miles above Wasilla, I think, right off the railroad. And I thought, well, gee whiz, if I get this, then I can just take it out to my homestead. That'll give me something to build out of, store my equipment in there, and really get moving. And sleep, stay there if I had to, because I knew I was going to have to get serious pretty soon. So I bid on it, and did I tell you what I paid for it? I was a high bidder at $15. Oh, that was just right in my budget, too. And so I bid on it, hadn't seen it, but I figured for $15 I couldn't go wrong. And then I drove out to it maybe a month later and saw it. It was there at Pittman Station as advertised. And I thought, well, this is great. I'll just pick that up. You had to come off the highway, go back to north. Once you got up the highway, cross the track, and the shed was right on the other side of the track. So I was going to have to get a truck to pull it over, lift it, park the truck on the track, lift the shed up, put it on the truck, take it out to the highway, then take it back again a couple of hundred yards for the other road that goes back to my homestead. Now, on the corner was Scatters. Any of you folks remember Scatter? Well, they call him Scatter because he shot a guy with a scatter gun. True story. He had a bar there on the corner. I thought, well, I can do this, but how am I going to lift this cabin up? It's a one-man job. I just had me. And I was in pretty good shape, but, you know, I can't lift a cabin. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to think about this. I went back, thought about it, didn't help much. And then I talked to Ben Herman. You folks must know Ben Herman. Herman Brothers, a great guy. Great guy. I saw him the other day over at the senior place. Went there for lunch, and there was Ben, still smiling, good guy. And I thought, well, gee whiz, he may have some ideas. Well, I told him my situation. He didn't respond that he had anything. I can't understand why. But I thought, let's give it a shot. So on a September Sunday afternoon at noon, or close to it, I went over to his place. He was having dinner there with his family. And I said, Ben, I got this problem. I got this cabin, and I got to get it to my homestead site. And I said, you know what might work is a crane. Oh, well, I don't have any cranes. But I have a boom truck. It's a 6x6. And I said, that'll be perfect. I'll just lift it up. And I don't have to put it on a bed. I'll just carry it, get it, cross the railroad track, lift it up, carry it out to the highway, and then take it down a couple of yards to where the road that was put in by Russ Birdsell, we used to call it the Birdsell Road, there it Scatters, and then take it back a couple of miles, and then a mile on the road that Bill Nelson it wasn't much of a road, built for me. And I said, hey, this is coming together. So he said, here are the keys. He said, here are the keys. I couldn't believe it. Well, I couldn't lose. And he said, here are the keys. And I knew where his yard was. I had seen it. I wasn't up here very long, just a year or so. Didn't know anybody, really. Living by myself. Met the people in the bank, but that's about all the folks I knew. So when Ben said that, I really felt lucky. So I got his 6x, told him I knew all about it. I had never driven a truck, but I knew I couldn't hurt it. I was going to be very careful. So I got it and started it and drove it, got up the highway, and everything was just right. I mean, I love it when a plan comes together like that. So I drove it up, crossed the railroad track, lined up with a cabin. Now the track's here, and the highway's there. I had to cross the tracks, park it on the tracks. Well, I reached over with the boom after I unleashed it, lifted it up, and took it out to the highway. And, it was dragging on the, I lost a couple of joists, you know, pulling down the highway. But anyhow, I got to the other, and so I lifted it up a little bit, and took it back on this road that goes to my homestead, eventually goes to my homestead. Now, I thought if this works out, I could get back, you know, by before it gets dark, and that's what I was looking for. So I took it back to the cabin site for this little cabin. It's not a shed anymore. It's cabin. Although there was some coal still in the corner of the thing. And no windows and a Dutch door. That was fine. That was going to be home if I needed it, but it was certainly my tool shed. And maneuvered the 6x around, had to cut down a few small trees to get on the blocks that I had set there before. Just cement blocks right on the ground. And got it worked, jiggled, lifted and lowered it and turned it. Got it there. Got it on. That was my foundation. Lowered the boom, took the chain off, and then moved it to the side and lowered the boom so I could drive out. So I lowered the boom after letting the cabin on the blocks and lashed it, drove it out. I was just ecstatic. There was my cabin. I didn't lose any blood. I mean, I got all of this done. So I drove out. And when I got to the railroad, I thought there had been an accident there. There were a couple of TPs. You guys know what that is. Territorial Police, we used to call them TPs. They were there, and Jake Wright. You folks know Jake. Jake Wright was really the law in Wasilla. He was the police, or the fire chief. He had a big handle bar and a cowboy hat and a bass voice, and you just listened to Jake, and he was a big guy. I saw Jake there. He waved, and I waved at him, and then there were a couple of federales there, too. I mean, you had some feds there, and you had a couple of these gasoline little crew cars that they drive on tracks, you know, And, of course, you had a couple of state guys. These federal guys were dressed up. And there was a real pile of them there. And so I drove out to the highway, and I pulled Jake over. I said, Jake, what the heck is all of this? What happened? Anybody get hurt? And he said, no, we're looking for some really big, bad vandals. And I said, what's up? And he said, well, somebody cut all the lines that go up to Fairbanks from Anchorage. The telephone, it's the worst thing. They had all the lines that follow the railroad tracks, all were cut. And I, of course, my boom was lashed down. And he said, well, let me know if you hear anything. I told him I would. Whoops!
Wow, fantastic. Thank you so much for that story. I think everyone's going to be talking about that for a while. So our final story for tonight, getting ready for winter, takes on a whole new meaning. In this story of discovery by Peter Storz called To Begin Again. Peter, give him a round of applause.
Indeed, everyone has a story to tell. And I have a story tonight to tell. That's true, just like all the others that you've heard. And this is a story about life and death and renewal. On August 12, 2014, my wife and I were in Hawaii on vacation. The day before we were to return to Alaska, I was involved in a water rescue of a man who had fallen in front of our condo we were renting. It was right before lunch. We were just preparing to have lunch, we heard a commotion below our balcony. I looked over the side. I didn't know what was going on, but I noted that there was something of import, and I decided I should go and help. A young woman, maybe 24 years old, who had worked at the hotel, a staff person, had heard the same commotion, and she crossed the beach. She went across carefully on a coral reef, about knee-deep high, and she reached a man who was face down in the water. Remarkably, a big person, she pulled him up on the reef. It took me about a minute to do the same. Looking on the side, no one wanted to go out there. I'd been an EMT before, and I felt confident that I could assist her as well. And so I did. I crossed the beach. I went carefully across the coral, my sandals. I reached the man, and she was performing CPR. I recall putting my hand on his shoulder, and I said to him, "Don't give up, buddy. It's not your time to leave yet." And with that, we continued to do CPR. Eventually, several other people from the resort came to assist. We heard sirens in the background. There's a lot of commotion. There were probably at least a dozen EMTs, police officers, fire department. But they were all up on the shore. I detected a pulse on this man, and I called for a backboard. And with that, the response that I got was, "Well, just bring him off the reef. Bring him up to the beach." We did that. Now there was another man and two other women, so there are five of us working on this guy. We bring him to the beach, and still, none of those professionals came to our rescue. It was really frustrating, disappointing, aggravating, all those things. And here, you know, the response should be, when someone says, "Man, I got a pulse," they should have an earnest desire to jump and let's go. We can, you know, provide other life-saving measures. Well, my take on it was that young woman who had just been certified in CPR was betrayed that day, because in those of you that have been trained in CPR know that as a first responder, you do the first thing to keep that person alive. When the people with higher training and ability come, they're to take over. They have the other materials and supplies, expertise to do the next route. They were up on the shore. They were saying, "Oh, just bring them closer." So we brought them off the reef. We brought them to the beach. You know what? They said, "Bring them higher. Bring them up here to the mowed lawn of the hotel." Well, we lugged his body. He was a big person. Five of us bringing him up there. And even then, they were reluctant, lackadaisical. They just weren't engaged. And I just said, "Holy smokes." And of course, they didn't know who I was or what my expertise was. It was even then that I had to engage them, get some oxygen on this guy, bag him. And they were just like not doing anything. Well, we found out, evidently, that the contract EMT service, their protocol was not to go into the water to rescue anyone. And my wife had heard an EMT or a firefighter, she overheard them telling another one, "We thought this was a body recovery. Our dispatcher said this person had been in the water for over 30 minutes. So that was, you know, kind of the end of that story. Well, we returned to Alaska. We had an interesting story to tell. But I kept in contact with the hotel manager because I'd been involved in search and rescue and emergency medical services in the past. I felt it important to help her and her community have a better response. And I helped her write a letter to the mayor and to communicate with the emergency medical system personnel there. And through that, I found out that this man who obviously, when I saw him, he had a gash on his head. He looked ashen. He was obviously dead. Well, he was in the hospital for 3 days, and he fully recovered. It's really remarkable, because someone that ingests water, they could get pneumonia, all kinds of things can happen, but he had fully recovered. I felt compelled to communicate with this guy, to engage him, to write him. Who was he? Did he have a recollection of making the choice to come back to live? Who was he? I got the address from the folks at the hotel. I sat down and I wrote him a letter. That in itself was unusual, because although I've been involved in accident scenes and people that have passed over before and people that have hopefully survived, I never sat down and wrote them a letter, but I just was compelled to do it. But that's not the end of the story. I wrote my letter on August 19th. A week later, I got the letter back. Had a stamp on it, says not deliverable as addressed, deceased. Holy smokes. Well, here we were just celebrating this remarkable, miraculous recovery, and this guy dies again? I thought, what's going on? Well, I had his name, went online, and I found out the rest of the story. There it was. Kauai police identify man found dead in waters off Waialua Golf Course. Police identify the man as John Philip McCoy, 50. An autopsy confirmed he had drowned. No foul play is suspected. So McCoy had died again 2 days before I had written my letter. That was over 2 weeks after he first drowned. It was just 3 miles down the coast. I looked at the envelope addressed to McCoy and opened it and tried to recall what I had written. And there they were. My own affirmations, my own advice, and hopes to someone I had not met but felt very intimately connected to. Somehow, this letter, written to that other person, came back to me for me. The advice I gave to another was a gift to be savored. Among other things, I suggested to him that his recovery and survival was a real miracle. I stated, "You have been given the proverbial golden second chance." Not necessarily to do something over, but to begin again. Well, it's now September in Palmer. It's that time between early fall and winter. And all the transitions that predictably occur are occurring right now. Big storm's going to be coming up here in the next 2 days. All those things are happening. So the change of seasons is a metaphor for my own life. I retired nearly 3 years ago, and it's now time to prepare for that next chapter in my life, winter. Just like the inescapable seasonal changes in nature, it's happening to me, so why not anticipate it and accept it? And perhaps, more importantly, to do so with intention. There's a person named Bronnie Ware. Bronnie Ware is a palliative care hospice nurse. And she identified common emotions encountered by people facing death. Ware has written a book called The Five Regrets of the Dying. and she identifies the number one regret people when they face death, and that is, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. So it's now time. I'm reading, I'm learning, I'm preparing about that new transition, this new phase. It helps me have a better understanding and appreciation, even a peace about my life. I'm part of a cycle that repeats itself. No regrets. No regrets. The water rescue I was involved in 2 years ago, and the gift of this letter back to myself, is really encouraging. I have really unanticipated appreciation and gratitude. I have the choice to live with happiness. I have the choice to live with a greater purpose, with joy, courage, a sense of adventure, a helping hand and inspiration to others, and anticipation for the future, not the end. So even in the dead of winter, there is something to ponder, bigger, to the meaning of that long dark. That stillness, the quietude, the time of waiting and incubation, being unattached to the flurry of productivity and doing, not having to know the why or the what or the how, but just being. It's poignant that the gift of darkness in the winter reveals the cosmos, the night sky, the wisdom and knowingness that we're all connected to the past and to the future, and that it will be revealed in a great mystery. So on the darkest and shortest of days, winter solstice, December 21st, here in Palmer we have 5 hours and 18 minutes, something remarkable happens. It's the turning, of course. First, seconds in December, then minutes in January. A new year, a new cycle, the emergence of renewal. And I recount my own words. Take every moment now, John, to appreciate all you can do with your life. Not necessarily to do something over, but to begin again. Thank you. There are just stories within stories in a very, very quick epilogue. While I was finishing my last touches on this, I got an email from my sister this afternoon. And these things happen. I want to tell you, it does happen. These things happen to me. She told me, she said, I just had this incredible experience this afternoon. Mom and Pat were with me. My mom died 4 years ago. Pat, a very good friend of hers, died 2 years ago. And I said, Kathy, you have no idea what I'm preparing, what I'm doing right now. This is all connected to something else. And she wrote back and she said, yes, it really is. And I told her, I'm doing this story tonight. She said, if there's anything that you say, let them know I had a happy dance of connection, feelings of love and protection, The biggest thing to tell tonight is do not be afraid. What an interesting compliment to the other things that have happened along the way. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Peter. Well, we have enjoyed some amazing stories tonight, haven't we? And we want to thank all of you for sharing your stories. One of my heroes, Maya Angelou, says, "There is no agony like bearing an untold story inside of you." The question is not, do you have a story? The question is, will you share your story? Tell it to a spouse, a child, a friend, a classroom. Or think about sharing it at next year's installment of Untold Stories. We thank you for coming and sharing this time with us. I would love to have all of our fabulous storytellers come up to the front right now so we can acknowledge who you are and give you one more big round of applause. All of our storytellers. Yes, keep the applause coming. It takes a lot of guts to come up here, share a story. So we thank you. Awesome. Yes, well deserved, storytellers. Thank you. And I also want to acknowledge our fabulous musicians, the Cartes. Would you please come up here, Cartes? Thank you so much. I think we're going to get to hear some more music at the end. And so I want to thank you again. My name is Kai West, and I'm honored to be the MC of this event. So enjoy the rest of your evening. Good? Okay.